7. Maddie and Brewster sat to Gilbert's right on a tufted velvet bench seat. They both held on for dear life and leaned as far away from him as they could, making room for his elbows as he used both hands to manhandle both a tiller and a throttle lever. The horseless carriage's 3 oversized bicycle wheels fought back against Gilbert's attempts to steer, sliding down into the ruts between paving stones instead of rolling over them. The squawking leaf spring suspension exaggerated the bumps instead of softening them, and the high position of the bench gave the twins the impression that they were perched on top of the vehicle rather than riding in it.
"You call this thing a car?"
Maddie shouted. Gilbert didn't answer, as he was concentrating on steering the 3-wheeled beast through the darkness of the gaslit London streets. Sid shouted,
"It's not just a car, it's an electric car!"
He'd volunteered to give up his customary place on the bench. For his kindness, he got to ride on the back, where there was no seat. He braced his feet on the frame, straddling the single rear wheel. His fingers dug into the seat back, and his tuxedo tails flapped in the wind as he suspended his body above the spinning tire. If his right foot slipped, he would surely fall from the back of the car, landing on and essentially getting peeled out on by the tire as he went. It was a grim prospect, but preferable to his left foot slipping, which would have the same result with the added problem of getting tangled in the drive belt.
"It's called the Ryker Electric, well ahead of its time, and not just because it shares its name with the first officer of the Enterprise. They had electric cars back now?"
Brewster asked.
"Time travel makes it hard to frame a sentence sometimes," Gilbert grunted, holding the throttle lever steady with his left hand while using his right to wrestle the tiller as the car rounded a corner, its solid rubber tires sliding on the wet stones. "You get used to it. And yeah, they had electric cars. Of course, we modified this one, put in a Tesla drivetrain. Can't go above 10% throttle or else the torque'll rip the frame apart, but still, it's good to know we have the power if we need it."
A horse hitched to a hansom cab bucked and whinnied as the Ryker passed. The man holding the reins shouted something, but he was already too far behind them to be audible. Maddie asked,
"How is this better than a carriage?"
"It very much is not," Sid said. "But it draws ever so much more attention, which is, to us, the most important thing. We'll explain further when we arrive home."
They creaked and clattered and squeaked their way through the darkened streets without talking, as conversation required too much effort to be worthwhile. They only broke what was passing for the silence when Gilbert pulled back on the throttle lever, slowing the Ryker Electric.
"Are we there?"
Brewster asked.
"Almost," Gilbert answered. "Just a block or so left to go. I have to slow down now to reduce wear on the leather brake pads."
The Ryker Electric tricycle nearly coasted to a stop by the waterfront on its own. Gilbert stomped on the brake pedal at the last moment, bringing the vehicle to a halt. They all climbed down from the contraption, and Maddie and Brewster followed the two magicians as they walked toward the docks. Sid used a large iron key, the kind that one sees in old cartoons or movies about dungeons or pirates, and slotted it into a padlock holding a metal gate shut. Turning the key, operating the latch, and opening the gate, each emitted a separate, unique, and irritating squeak. Inside the gate, all the kids could see was a dock leading into the darkened river, a thick rope tied to a mooring cleat stretching up into the black night sky, and what appeared to be some machinery wired to a rusted old searchlight. Brewster squinted into the darkness.
"So do you two live on a houseboat, or are we gonna have to row across the river?"
Gilbert opened an electrical panel and smiled at Brewster.
"Neither," he said,
and threw a large Dr. Frankenstein-style knife switch. With a loud mechanical clunk and a dangerous-sounding buzz, the searchlight sprang to life, A blinding white beam of light shot straight up into the sky 400 feet above them, where it illuminated a huge airship painted with the message, "Go see the great Gilbert and the sensational Sid, professional purveyors of authentic amazement, always to a higher standard than the competition." On either side of the word competition, caricatures of Sid and Gilbert stood on the top hats of an annoyed-looking Martin and Philip. Gilbert threw a second knife switch. Up on the airship, a basket similar to one that would hang beneath a hot air balloon began to descend from the gondola.
"You live in a blimp?"
Maddie asked.
"Dirigible," Sid said. "A blimp derives its shape from internal gas pressure. A dirigible, such as ours, boasts a rigid internal structure."
"But you live in it?"
Sid nodded crisply.
"Affirmative, young lady. It's good for the image, you see. We live in a technological marvel that impresses and frightens the populace. We commute to work in a technological marvel that impresses and frightens the populace. Then at work we perform feats that impress and frighten the populace. Maintaining our image at all times helps us stand out from the competition."
"Dad and Philip."
"Yes."
"And do you?" Brewster asked. "Stand out from Dad, I mean."
"Bit of a sore spot, that," Gilbert said. "Your father and Philip do get more attention at the moment, but we'll figure a way to upstage them."
"How are they getting more attention than you, with your dirigible and your electric three-wheeler?"
"By never showing their faces. As far as the audience can see, your father and Philip never leave their theater. Martin goes home to you lot, and Philip goes to his shed without ever setting foot outside."
"They can't be bothered to provide a convincing cover story,"
Sid grumbled.
"And because whatever they're up to takes place in secret, the public assumes that it must be something far more impressive than our dirigible, simply because they don't know what it is."
The wicker basket touched down. Sid opened a door built into the side and motioned for the kids to enter. Brewster asked,
"Is it safe?"
Sid stepped into the basket himself.
"Does it seem likely that I would ride in it if it weren't?"
Maddie said, "You just rode on the back of that motorized tricycle." Gilbert laughed.
"The lady's got you there, Sid. Look, we promise it's safe. Besides, you can't tell me you don't want to see the inside of our dirigible."
Maddie stepped into the basket. After a moment's hesitation, Brewster followed. Gilbert stepped in as well, closing the door behind them. He waved his white-tipped ebony walking stick toward the electrical box. One of the knife switches appeared to throw itself, causing the basket to rise.
"Okay, when are you going to tell us how you're doing this stuff?"
Instead of seeming awestruck or even impressed, Maddie sounded irritated. Sid and Gilbert exchanged a concerned look. Then Gilbert said,
"In a bit. We'll tell you everything we can. Enough at least for all this stuff you've seen to make sense. First, I think you two should tell us what's been going on with your parents so we can figure out how to help. Fair enough?"
Neither Maddie nor Brewster said anything. Riding in a wicker basket as it traveled up a rope to a dirigible hundreds of feet over the ground didn't leave either of them in a chatty mood. An aperture like the iris in an expensive camera, only much larger and made of what looked like copper, opened in the floor of the gondola above them. Warm yellow light spilled out, drawing the attention of the twins. They stared up into the light like moths approaching a flame and remained silent as the basket rose through the opening, which closed behind them, leaving nothing but the guide rope hanging in the cold night air. Maddie and Brewster sat in the cramped but sumptuously decorated Victorian parlor, built inside the dirigible's gondola, on a small red velvet couch with gracefully turned wooden legs, holding tiny, delicate china cups full of hot chocolate as they told Sid and Gilbert their entire story. They started with Philip's mysterious appearance in their home and ended with their arrival at Gilbert and Sid's theater. They took turns talking, and each made sure that their sibling left out no detail, no matter how weird. Sid and Gilbert sat opposite them in armchairs that matched the couch. They listened carefully, asking the occasional question to clarify some specific detail or other, and requested that Brewster and Maddie write down the date and time when their parents got frozen, along with their street address. Once the twins had disgorged the entire tale, the magicians excused themselves, saying that they needed to discuss what they'd heard. They opened a hatch in the ceiling, climbed up a telescoping brass ladder, and closed the hatch behind them. After several seconds of silence, Maddie said,
"I guess there's a second floor."
"I guess," Brewster said.
Maddie frowned at him and clarified her point.
"Clearly it must extend up into the balloon."
"Clearly."
"Look, it's not like you've ever been up in a dirigible before."
"What? I'm agreeing with you."
"But you're doing it in a way to make it sound like I'm stupid."
"Why would I agree with someone who I thought was stupid? That's stupid."
"So now you admit you think I'm stupid."
"Yeah, now, about this."
The twins heard the hatch above them open and instantly stopped bickering, watching in silence as Sid and Gilbert climbed down the ladder to stand before them. Sid said,
"We've thoroughly discussed the issues at hand, and we have a few specific points we'd like to address. First, we want you to know how deeply impressed we are with both of you. You've shown great courage, adaptability, and teamwork, aside from the immature, pointless argument we heard clearly through the hatch."
Brewster said,
"Thank you."
"Yes, thanks," Maddie said. "And he started it."
"I did not,"
Gilbert said.
"You did, mate."
Sid nodded.
"Indeed, but it's quite understandable. You've both been under a tremendous amount of stress, and you are, after all, siblings. We often take that sort of thing out on the people who are closest to us."
"Because they're the ones who are there."
"Quite right, Gilbert, quite right. At any rate, we've decided to assist you in any way we can."
"You'll help us get Philip?" Maddie asked.
"That depends," Sid said, "on what you mean by get. If you mean that we will help you find Philip so that he may explain himself, then absolutely, yes, we will. If you mean that we'll assist you in tracking him down and exacting some sort of grim retribution, then I'm afraid you'll be disappointed. We simply don't believe that Philip would ever deliberately harm your parents."
Brewster said,
"We know what we saw."
Gilbert said,
"Sorry, kid, but it seems to me that you didn't see anything. What you said is that you heard some things, then found Philip gone and your parents doing their Pompeii act."
Sid held up a finger to silence Gilbert and the twins.
"We know what you two believe, and we aren't claiming that you don't have your reasons. Suffice it to say that the discrepancy between what you believe of Philip and what we know of him is part of what, to the bottom of which, we're anxious to get. Acceptable?"
Maddie and Brewster nodded.
"Splendid. Toward that end, we are now going to explain more or less everything."
"Everything?"
Brewster asked. Gilbert nodded.
"Yep. All of it. The time travel, the teleportation, your parents' condition, the lot. The full welcome to the desert of the real treatment."
The four of them remained in an awkward silence for a moment until Maddie said,
"Great! Good, we'd like that. Wouldn't we, Brewster?"
"Yeah, totally. Bring it on."
Sid said,
"I assure you, my young friend, on is exactly where we intend to bring it."
Just not here, Gilbert said. There's something we want to show you first.